Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. Oh, a special program today. I've got Doug Dowd on as my guest from Italy. Imagine a man, a professor, who I don't think is really retired yet. I know the last time I had him on my program, he was still teaching part-time for sure. At age 93, he's still writing books. And imagine writing the one he just did. We'll talk about it during the program. He not only wrote it, he wants everybody to be able to read it free of charge. If you go to Doug Dowd, D-O-W-D, .org, or just Google Doug Dowd, and you'll find his website, and you'll find all his books listed, and you'll find his newest book. You'll find a spot to click that says, what did it say? Download this manuscript. Anyway, in very clear directions, it says click here and you can read this book. Imagine another writer doing something like that. Doug is very special. And at 93, he is still, I hope he's going strong, maybe at a slower pace than some years earlier, if I make it to that age. A lot slower. Doug, I guess you call yourself an economic historian, among other places. You've taught at Cornell, at University of California, elsewhere as well. The last time you were on, you were still teaching part-time. Are you still doing it?
Oh, I stopped teaching last year. I taught for last year, and then when it ended, when the semester ended, I had to go back and forth on a train from Bologna, where I was teaching in Modena, and just getting back and forth on the train was dangerous for me. And a friend sitting in one of the classes that I gave told me that it looked to him as though I was beginning to lose my memory just a little bit, and he was right. Anyhow, so I decided to quit before they had to fire me. I'm still writing, but I don't want to teach anymore.
You're still well, commuting is tough even at a younger age, I must say. I live downtown in Chicago, and I avoided a commute for most of my working years by being very close to where I had to work and able to get home. And my family really preferred it that way, Doug, because get out in the suburbs and you get caught in the kind of traffic that I know and I have experienced that Chicago has. And you could spend an hour getting in the morning, maybe longer, an hour getting home at night, and putting long hours in at work. My goodness, families would never get to see their husbands or fathers. So mine was very delighted that we lived downtown. Luckily, we had a very decent school for my kids, and it all worked out very well for me. Let's talk about your book. The title is very unusual. The World Economy, Beginnings, Maturation, and Deterioration? Question mark. Well, I worry about the same thing, Doug. Let me let you talk about it.
Well, the world economy, if you read history, you'll see references to the world economy of the 19th century and the world economy of the 20th century up to into World War II. But there's never been anything like a real world economy until after World War II. There wasn't the kind of participation that is going on now globally, geographically. It's really almost impossible to find any place on the world that is not involved in some substantial way with the world economy, either both buying and selling. And the United States, of course, is in the center of that, and it's the most powerful of all the economies up to now. And there's no question at all in my mind, unfortunately, that one after another of the major economies is moving into the trouble world. Now, you, as people might know but not have paid much attention to, Japan was one of the first to do that, and it never got out of the trouble it got into over 10 years ago. And the United States has been in trouble now since at least 5, 7, or 8 years. And what happens, and now I might add that Western Europe is also now consciously going into trouble. And the thing that's really sort of worrisome, among many other things that are worrisome, is that no matter where or when something like this happens, begins to happen, all you have to do is wait a couple of weeks or a month or two, and you will find in the headlines saying that the economy is okay again, or it's going to be okay tomorrow or next week or something like that. And if you have anything at all about history, and it's time that everybody learned a little bit, at least, about history, it's as though they're making these statements as quotations from 1929, 1930, 31, 32, 33, 34. When the worst depression in history began, for at least 7 or 8 years, it kept being referred to as something that was kind of a passing problem. And that's happening now again. And the problem today now is much more serious than it was in the interwar in the 1930s, although what was also very, very serious there was, of course, the existence of fascism in a half a dozen different countries, and World War II were right around the corner. So we're very different in that respect, I hope. About the fascism, I think, we're out of, and so on. Anyhow, that's where we are now, and I'll stop making those generalizations, and if you wish to, you can push me to something more particular.
Well, I worry about these things too, Doug, and I'm certainly, I don't write about them the way you do, but I do write about them in addressing issues of war and peace and the economy. My goodness, I had one book on how Wall Street fleeces America, and I'm working on a follow-up one to it as well, and I'm very concerned about the state of the economy, mainly in Western societies and also in Japan. Japan has been in a downturn or a malaise, it seems like, forever. Almost forever, and only an ocean of money there and an ocean of money in America and Western societies keeps possibly all of the major economies from crashing. I mean, literally, things were that bad in 2008. They were beginning to crater with the dot-com bubble that crashed in 2000. Then there was an artificial recovery based on an ocean of money, but that ocean was minor compared to the ocean after Greenspan gave way to Ben Bernanke at the Fed. I think that was in 2006. So, I mean, he literally has been a one-man wrecking crew. He tripled the Fed's balance sheet. He shows no signs of stopping. And you simply, I mean, you can't create prosperity on an ocean of money that does not go into creating economic growth. If it goes to the banks, which is where it's going, to let them speculate and keep themselves alive, even though they're all broke, insolvent, dare I say bankrupt, they should be shut down. And if they're not shut down, they should be broken. Well, I don't even want to break them up. I want to get rid of them because they're the problem, Doug. They literally are the problem. And when we talk about bailing out a country, we're not bailing out a country like Greece or Italy or Portugal or Ireland and others coming up, Spain, Italy. We're not bailing out countries, Doug. We're bailing out banks. They give them a big so-called bailout, but I don't think they ever see the money. I think the money goes direct from the contributors, the nations or the IMF or whatever, to the banks. And this thing keeps going and going and going. It's the same thing in America, and people are left high and dry. I'm sure in your life, Doug, and certainly in mine, about 15 years your junior, I mean, nothing like this has ever remotely happened before. And unless people figure out what's happening and really take issue with it and do more than sporadic protests in small numbers, this thing is going to go on and get worse. And I see America ending up despotic banana republic in the worst sense of the word, and I remember writing an article about that.
Well, the thing that's been implicit, or somewhat explicit, but also implicit in what you've just been saying, is this. You kept talking about finance, about the banks, and so on and so on. For the first time in history, the first time in all of history, until you go back to the medieval world, which is not the modern world at all, for the first time in history, the dominant sector of the economy is now finance. And even worse than that, the dominant sector of finance is speculation. And if you read the news every day, whether you're reading about Germany or Italy or France or Britain or the United States, you read that the kinds of measures that are being taken to deal with the crisis are all measures which are controlled principally by the financial world. That is to say, it's really insane what's going on right now, that it's required every, whether you're looking out at France or Italy or the United States or Britain, that what is happening is that the main device, Greece and so on, the main device that is being used within the framework of this very serious recession on the way to becoming a depression, by having policy be kept back only to taking care of what the banks want. And what the banks want is to have some kind of security about their future, and that means to them to have as the main policy being one that takes care of the security of the banks, and which is to say, to control how the economy is financed and so on and so on, and have it financed by, in effect, the rules of the want the banks want, that the finance wants, and it nowhere, very very practically nobody points out that the crisis that we're in is the crisis that was brought to us by the financial system and by its ability to control the whole economy, which is something that was absolutely new in this period. A period which began about 40, 50 years ago. And that's what we have to face, and I don't know how we're going to face it except by a political movement which has as its aim to see to it that the main criterion of public policy is one that starts first and foremost with the needs of the population rather than the needs of the bank or the wants of the bank. And we can go on from there if you wish.
Well, indeed so, Doug. And unfortunately, social America, and I'm afraid social Europe, you're in Italy, it very much is the case in Italy, where a prime minister who was nothing more than a corporate tycoon literally was replaced by a Goldman Sachs-connected banker, unelected. And of course, Greece, the same thing, another Goldman Sachs connected banker replaced an elected prime minister, not that he was any good either. But what kind of democracy runs a country that way? But literally, social societies are being destroyed to make rich people a lot richer, starting with the big financial interests, of course, the big banks, the big European banks, the big Wall Street banks. And I mean, literally, they're destroying people. Destroying people, destroying communities, destroying countries, so that these people can profit and amass unimaginable fortunes. I mean, I don't know how much these people want. I mean, they want money, they want power, and as much of it as they get, they want more, and they keep getting more on the backs of ordinary people. And poverty in America, I believe, is at record levels, at least in modern times. Unemployment is nearly three times the official number because they corrupt the data and they don't tell the truth. Long-term unemployed, etc., aren't even counted. It's a terribly corrupted system, and in America, I literally have given up on the political process, Doug. Republicans are no different from Democrats. Democrats are no different from Republicans on issues mattering most, economic interests, corporate interests, war and peace.
Well, of course, that's what you're worried about and angry about has been just a couple of years ago. It was made easier for the bad things to go on to get even worse. And that is to say that now, and since for 2 years now, there's been made possible for no limit at all on how much financial effort can be made by banks or by the rich in order to see that the elections go their way. And now what happened after the 1930s, during and after the 1930s, was that all kinds of regulations were put into effect to prevent this from happening. And what's been happening since the 1970s, and especially since the 1990s, as, unfortunately under the Democratic rule in the 90s, is that the richer people are, the more freedom they have to do with whatever they want to do. When I say the richer people are, I mean the richer that the political groups are. And it's just extraordinary how much freedom now there is for the very powerful to spend as much money as they wanted to corrupt anybody in any office, anywhere, at any level. And it's really just scary. Now, the kind of worry that you expressed I certainly worry myself just as much, or at least just as much. But what we have to understand is that what you've said is correct. But then the question is, so what are we going to do about it? And there has to be one answer, and the answer to there has to be a very strong growth of political participation on the part of ordinary people, instead of having the political participation be totally dominated by, first and foremost, the financial system, and secondly, after that, and very much linked, the military system. And that we're in a terrible crisis, and when I say we, I mean the world, because what's happening in the United States is something which is spreading like a disease all over the world, economically and politically. So somehow or another, we have to find ways, and the only ways we can find are the participation, people spending some time politically, and giving up what they've been doing, screwing around for whatever reason they're screwing around, and become politically involved. And to become politically involved, I speak from experience and from observation, means more than just spending some time. It means spending some time thinking and worrying and participating and becoming part of an actual movement that takes time and sacrifice and so on. It means we have to change our way of being. To put it differently, you cannot have the kind of political participation by the people that is necessary unless they stop doing some of the things, mostly the things that they do with respect to watching television and its links. Anyhow, I'll stop talking. You can start talking again.
Oh, Doug, I absolutely agree with you so fundamentally. I make the same point all the time. People don't realize how much power they have, and they don't realize that unless they use it, nothing will change. It'll just get worse. Change never comes from the top down.
It never has in human history. People
will not give up what they have without being forced to give it up. I wrote an article a few days ago explaining how the Vietnam War ended. It was an article on Afghanistan, but I wanted to explain about the events going on there, about comments made about it, and so on. I went into a lot of issues, but in the article I explained how simple it is to end that war. People don't realize how simple it is. I mean, even doing the right thing won't get it to end overnight. It took years for the right thing to get the Vietnam War ended. But what ended it? It wasn't the courage of the Vietnamese resistance, North and South. I mean, that helped, absolutely. But that wasn't what ended the war. The Taliban won't end the war in Afghanistan. The Iraqis won't get the Americans out on their own. What ended the war was public rage. They did it nonviolently. They sustained it for years. In the 1960s, the early 1960s, it was irrepressible. Congress simply could not forever ignore this, and they didn't. And they finally, after years, did the right thing. They cut off the funding. Congress funds wars. The House really is the one that does it. The Senate has say too. They both have to ratify this. But Congress has the power of the purse. They turn it on, and these wars will go on forever, and more of them right after them. You cut it off, and they come to a screeching end, and that's what happened in Vietnam. I also, in the same article, and I've said this before in past articles, in 1965, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara leveled with Lyndon Johnson, and he told him, there is no way we can win this war. Lyndon Johnson knew it. Richard Nixon knew it. It took a decade before the damn thing ended, and even then, only because of sustained public pressure. If that pressure isn't exerted today, we'll get another 10 years of war in Afghanistan. We'll get two or three more in the meantime. Syria, Iran, my goodness, where does it end? And every dollar spent on militarism and wars, as you well know, Doug, is one less dollar spent on vital social needs that are literally being trashed so we can take care of the profit, the war profiteers and the big bankers and the other corporate favorites and ordinary people. In the eyes of Democrats and Republicans, it's a bipartisan issue. Ordinary people can go to hell. We don't care about you. Go to hell.
Well, I agree with what you're saying, but then, as I did a few minutes ago, I also respond by saying what the people have to do is become politically involved instead of just angry and worried and so on. I agree with you. One other thing I would add is that you said something about 10 years, the 10 years war and so on and so on. I'm afraid I think it's much worse than that. If the United States, for example, allows itself to be pulled into the war in Iran by Israel, which is absolute suicide for Israel, and they know it's suicide for them, so they know they have to bring the United States in, and they will do that unless the people of the United States stop it. Unless they bring the United States in, they cannot win. But what we're talking about when we talk about that war in Iran, and it's almost now a certainty, is the first stage in a next series of wars centered in Asia, Western Asia, but spreading from there. I mean, for example, a war between Pakistan and India, and so on and so on. What we're talking about is the beginnings of the Third World War. And it isn't a question of some happening overnight. It's a tendency that is now well underway, so that the probability of the 10 years from now is that if there is a major war where we're now on the edge of having, that will spread and spread and spread until we go at the end of the world. Because the kind of weaponry, I'm sure the 10 or 11 countries now have the atomic bomb, and Iran is struggling, I should say, sensibly to have it themselves, sensibly and distracted and dangerously. But you can understand if you were somebody living in that country, you would think, well, it looks as though we must have the atomic bombs too, and so on and so on and so on and so on. And so Israel has it, although they deny it, and the United States knows damn well that they have it, and we don't admit it, and so on. And it's just that we're just in a basically insane world. Now, it's easy to say that, but I think that those of us who say that, you and me and others, must understand that they, in saying that, they are also making an obligation that they have to help to fulfill. And that is to say that there is a popular political movement, whether we're speaking about Britain or the United States or Italy or whatever, a popular political movement in which people designate to themselves that they have to spend a substantial amount of time politically learning and doing, working with other people and working with them for decency and for peace and safety and so on. And I must say that I'm scared as hell that this cannot be done, but that doesn't mean I would stop trying, and nor will you. But I'm sorry, because people have been so hypnotized by being consumerists rather than human beings, and if there's anything that's on the mind, let's say of the United States, if there's anything that's mostly on their mind right now, it isn't the problems of war and peace, it's the problems of how the hell are they going to pay off their debts, and how the hell are they going to keep their jobs or get a job, and so on and so on. And there's only one answer to that, and that is that the people have to take over the country politically. Now, that can't be done overnight. It can't be done in a week or even a year or two or three. But what can be done overnight is for the people who realize that there's a terrible problem to change the way that they live and become political people instead of people who are just pissed off or people just angry or people who are just worried. That's what we have to have. I don't know how that can be brought about, but I know that that's the sort of thing when I write all of my political work has as its intention to try to assist people to make those movements, to realize they need to.
Indeed so, Doug, and big things have been accomplished before, not as often as we wish they were in America and across Europe, but in America, my goodness, I don't even count the so-called American Revolution, because ordinary people really, they may have been enlisted to fight, but it was really a war of American elitists against UK elitists, more than a true revolutionary war from the bottom up. But aside from that, major things were accomplished. They can happen again. Years of struggle brought labor reforms, real labor reforms. We actually had a real labor act benefiting labor in the 1930s under Franklin Roosevelt. Civil rights, because of wonderful people like Martin Luther King. I mean the effort and the eloquence that he put into it for years from the 1950s. And finally, toward the mid-1960s, we got the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. They're all gone now. All those benefits are washed away and gone. And the civil rights leaders of today will tell you that the things are at least as bad as they were before any of this came to pass, including Brown versus Board of Education in the 1950s. Labor, I mean, honest labor people, I don't know how many of them there are around, but the few who are around will say that all the labor rights won decades back, they're all gone. I mean, unions have been absolutely decimated, mainly private ones, and in the 1950s, about 35% of American workers were unionized, and it dropped. I haven't looked at the latest number, but it dropped down to something like 10 or 12%. And in the private sector, something like 6 or 7%. And all the rights are just gone. The corporations have taken over everything. And you go from one issue to another, Doug.
Well, everything that you're saying is true. I agree with it. What I'm saying is that the people who are listening to this, and some millions who are not listening to it, have to become politically involved themselves, because it's not going to come down from heaven, and it's not going to come down from the people who are now in Congress or in politics, because they are almost entirely, as you pointed out a minute ago, corrupted, bought and paid for. And there's no way to change that unless ordinary people become involved politically, not just reading the newspaper and feeling pissed off and so on, but become active, trying to do what they can, what we can, to build a political movement. I mean, for example, what's been going on recently with the in New York and all over the country, the people raising hell with finance.
The Occupy Wall Street movement.
That's a beginning. That's a good beginning. But it has to. All of those movements have been focused on finance, and in a particular city, it's the nation that has to be politicized, and it has to be moved away from just trying to straighten out the financial world and straighten out the whole economy and the whole system of democracy. We have to have a functionally democratic society. We don't have one. What we have is a society which is democratic in name but not in practice. And the fault of that is that has to be held in part, big part, by the people who don't do anything themselves politically except once in a while to read the newspaper. And we have to blame ourselves, not just the guys, the big people at the top who are creating all the problems, but we have to be upset with ourselves for not ever doing anything about it, for just sitting and reading the newspaper and being pissed off. I don't know where we can go from there in this program,
but that's exactly right, Doug. We're coming up to a break, to take a short break. And as soon as I hear a little music in the background, I'll go to break. But again, people literally have to get away from the distractions. All the distractions are there to keep people from focusing on what matters most. You know, you've got hundreds of TV channels. You've got sports, all kinds of sports going on year-round. You've got films. You've got shopping. You've got all of these distractions. And a lot of this is to effectively manipulate people's minds to keep them from thinking about affairs of state and war and peace and how wretched their lives may be if they find a pink slip when they walk into work the next day. Let's take a break on that, and we'll come right back and pick it up, Doug.
All right.
Welcome back. I'm on with Doug Dowd. We're talking about the state of the world. My goodness, it's kind of rocky, Doug. Can I make one comment? I focus on so many things, and before today, I wrote a number of articles on what's been going on in Bahrain for the last 14 months, absolutely nightmarish, under the world's the responsibility lies with one of the world's most repressive dictatorships. And people literally have been rallying peacefully on streets on a daily basis in huge numbers. Sometimes they
Where
come out
this talking about?
In Bahrain, one of the Gulf states.
Yeah.
And yesterday, and a new article I put out today, and one I wrote this morning, I'll get out tomorrow. I wrote about the Bahrain Grand Prix. The Bahrain Grand Prix. In 2011, it was canceled because of street protests and violence and all the disturbances. And the Formula One people who put this on, the Formula One circuit, they go from one city to another. They canceled out last year, but they didn't do it this year. And today, with violence raging in the streets, with people being brutalized, they're being assaulted, they're being beaten, some of them are being badly injured, there's been at least one death reported, I can't imagine there won't be more before this day is out, and they're running this race, and literally they've set up a cloistered area to try to be oblivious to what's going on in this deeply repressive country, a very tiny one, an island, connected to Saudi Arabia by a causeway, and the combination of Bahraini security forces and the Saudi military have literally been ravaging these people for over a year now. And this is going on, and because there's big money involved, and the Bahrain monarchy hoped to burnish its image by having this event, well, it backfired. It backfired big time. The U.S. media says very little about this. You'll find a story here or there in the New York Times, maybe the Washington Post. I think one story I saw in the Washington Post, they picked up an AP report. They didn't even have their own reporter writing about it. I didn't check what they had today. But the race is being run today, and the only other comment I'd make, aside from the outrage of Formula One and the guy who runs it, an 80-year-old guy by the name of Bill Ecclestone. I know nothing about racing. Bill Ecclestone, I discovered he's a billionaire. A billionaire. He runs lots of these races. He makes many millions more. Every time he runs one, he could have given this one up. Didn't mean anything. And he's oblivious to what's going on. The drivers don't even want to talk about it. A couple of them pulled out, but most of them are there. And I wonder, and this is being televised, as I understand it, around the world. I had to check to see if it's being televised in America. I couldn't find it. There's another NASCAR event being televised by Fox from Kansas City. I don't think it's Formula One, if I understand what Formula One is, but they're not televising this event. Maybe they had it planned, and they decided it was the better part of valor to choose another racing event. Well, that's what they're doing. So at least Americans cannot see this on the major networks. I don't know whether any local stations are picking it up. They sure could if they want to. You can get feeds from around the world very easily. But this is going on. I'll have my third straight article on it tomorrow. And the outrage, even some of the European mainstream papers, Doug, have not been treating this event and the people behind it.
I haven't seen one word about it. I have not seen one word about it in Italy.
Oh, my goodness. Well, if you read the London Guardian and the London Independent, you will see some critical journalism about it. But the New York Times pulls its punches. Washington Post, U.S. television, I don't monitor the news on television, but I would bet there's not a single report, not a single report on the violence leading up to this, a single report on what's going on today. All you get is the same mindless garbage focusing mainly, as far as I can tell, on the election, which is November. Well, they've been doing this for months. It's November, and in April they're talking about an election while the world is going up in flames, and all they can talk about is Romney versus Obama.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just one tragedy amongst many, 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 many tragedies going throughout the world. Most of them in the poorest countries, but also many of them in the rich countries. Like, there are a lot of people who are having it very, very hard in Britain and the United States and France and Italy and so on and so on. This is a tough world, and there's a responsibility that people like us who are living comfortably continue to live comfortably, but to spend a lot of time trying to make life decent for the rest of the people in the world. It's just disgusting, heartbreaking how much horror most people in the world suffer day to day, night to night. So, and somebody like myself who's tried to keep up with the news, I didn't know one word about what you've just been talking about.
It really is shocking. I have a friend in Italy, in Rome, who complains about the Italian media, and it doesn't surprise me at all. I know how bad the UK media is. The UK media are BBC. You certainly don't find out much of anything on BBC, maybe better than Fox or MSNBC, but it's owned by the British government. It's a propaganda service, just the way so-called public radio, national public radio, public television in America. There's no public in either of those. It's all corporate control, government propaganda, the usual garbage. And, I mean, hear a program like this, the idea that something like this could end up on a mainstream network is an absolute impossibility. It could never happen. And if somebody made a mistake, Doug, and actually mistakenly invited me on their program to comment about some issue, I don't think I could get more than 10 words out of my mouth before they would break for commercial and then say, oh, we lost our feed to the guest, and then move on to some other story.
Yeah. What's true for you is true for me, too. But anyway, so responsibility for the people who know that, you and me and people like us, is to do more and more political work. And even though we might never win, at least we'd be living honorably instead of just taking what's going on as something we hate and are angry about and letting it go on. And so it's a lot of work that has to be done. And it's something that has been done in the past once in a while, here and there, but it's not being done very much at all in the present. And the present needs that kind of work, political work, for genuine democracy all over the world. I mean, to say that we have a world economy is to say that we have very much the same kinds of horrors developing all over the world. They're the worst, of course, in the poorest countries, but you can find some horror in New York City, and you can find it in Chicago, you can find it in San Francisco, and you can find it in London also, in the richest countries in the world. So I don't know what to say other than people have become political. We have to find ways to see to it that a substantial percentage of the population becomes politically involved. Once they do, then I think there's every reason to believe that we can move in the right direction, as is going on right now in the cities of the people who are trying to knock down the financial system for doing its evils. So I don't know what you want to say beyond that.
Well, Doug, I think you can compare what you just said to people in their own families. It's their families, and if parents don't raise their kids right and teach them right, if they don't do it, it won't get done. And you can say the same thing about people in cities and communities and countries. It's their communities, it's their cities, it's their countries. If they don't care enough to see to it that they're run properly, then they'll get the kind of government we have now, and it'll just get worse, and the harm that's being done to them now will just get worse and worse. So it's up to them to care enough to want to do something and make it right. And it's not rocket science. They literally can make it right with the right effort put into it. And right now, of course, the opposite is going on, and the worst of all possible worlds keeps getting even worse, as hard as that is to imagine. But the idea of living in a world with endless wars and another one right behind it, I assure you there will be another war. My guess is it'll be against Syria. And if that happens, in whatever time frame passes, there'll be another one after that. I mean, they literally go on endlessly, one after another, and the same thing with the nurturing and caring of America's big corporate giants. The only thing the political establishment knows is take care of them, treat them well, lavish them with all of the wealth, and the way the government is run is the system is set up to keep transferring maximum public wealth to their hands, meaning depriving ordinary people of the same wealth, meaning impoverishing many people, putting many people out of work, not caring about creating jobs, creating a society not fit to live in. And I flat make that statement. The America I grew up in, Doug, and that you grew up in, was mirror different than the way it is today. And I speak of America today as a country not fit to live in, and I see it getting worse all the time, and I can't imagine what's coming down the road. Just the repressive police state laws that have been passed, the belligerence that's a way of life, the indifference to public need, the idea of a free social society, it literally is a non-starter. What kind of a country runs itself that way? What kind of a population lets the leaders do it? I mean, that's the bottom line for you and for me, Doug. It's intolerable that this goes on. It doesn't have to be. It shouldn't. And it wouldn't if people cared enough to do something about it.
Yeah, well, all that you and I can do is to do what you and I are doing, which is to do as much as we can to get other people to become involved politically and to move toward a decent society. And it's very difficult to do that. I mean, you have, for example, the program we're speaking on is one which is very rare, and it's very difficult for people to know that you even exist. The communication system is such that it's very, very difficult, almost impossible for decent human communication to get into the eyes or the ears of the average person. It's virtually impossible, made worse by the fact that the average person has now been, in some sense or another, tricked into paying attention to a lot of junk, silly junk, and so on and so on. And it's not their fault. It's partly our fault. It's the way of the system. The system is a money-making system, and the hell with everything else. Well, there's no way to change that except for people to change it. And the big problem that you and I face as we talk right now is how can we change it? How can we affect people in such a way that they will become politically involved to make a decent society, a safe society? And the answer is it's an uphill battle, and a very steep uphill battle. I must say, frankly, that I don't think we can win, and I think because we can't win that we're going to go into World War III, and that'll be the end of us. But I also say something else, and that is that what you're trying to do and what I'm trying to do is worthwhile in and of itself. Whether we can win or not is a big question. But even if we can't win, at least we're doing something that is decent and makes sense, and it's what human beings should do, which is to try to have a good world, not try to spend and buy and so on and so on. In other words, there are certain limits on what any of us can do, but those limits are not such that people cannot become politically involved. Why they don't, and they don't, most of them, is because they've been hypnotized into thinking that what's important is buying, selling, and buying, borrowing, and having fun and so on. Well, there's only so little we can do about that. You're trying to do it, I'm trying to do it, and I know that I don't know that we're going to fail, but I'm almost certainly we're going to fail. But that's no reason, as far as I'm concerned, to give up. I just don't believe in giving up.
Doug, I can't imagine doing anything other than what I'm doing now, and the benefits literally are priceless. I mean, I really feel, you know, none of us individually or even in groups can change the world, but there are some marvelous quotes that I remember and I've used in articles that I've written that have inspired me, along with absolutely extraordinary people like you. You and others like you have been role models for me. And inspire, I mean, literally, I on your shoulders I rest to do whatever little I can. One of the marvelous quotes that I remember, the muckraking journalist I.F. Stone, you probably remember him better than I do. I remember him. But,
I remember him very well, and I know him pretty well, too.
Did you know him personally?
Oh, sure.
Oh, my goodness.
Shoulders.
Way back, I mean, he actually got on mainstream television, and they didn't like what he said, so they didn't keep him on that for that long a period of time. But on news programs like Meet the Press, he got on one of those programs in the 1940s, I believe, debating universal health care.
Yeah,
I can't imagine that.
He was a tough guy. Nobody could stop him. He was a very tough guy and a very nice guy too.
I wish I could have known him, Doug. But one of his marvelous quotes was, it may be the best one he ever made, was, "The only battles I can't," it was a long quote, and I'll paraphrase it. He said, "The only battles worth winnings with fighting are the ones you know you're going to lose."
Yeah, because, that's what we're talking about.
Because if you keep at it and you inspire people to come up behind you and get in that fight, and maybe they'll lose, but they'll inspire others, and sooner or later, on the backs of all the people who lost out, not because they didn't try, but because winning this kind of battle is a very long-term operation, but because of what you did and what all the others who did the same thing, one day someone will win. Someone will. They may not remember you, but it was because of what you did and the others like you that made it possible for someone eventually, who you'll never meet, to win. And that's the way great battles are won. That's right. They're never won quickly. It takes years to win kinds of fights. And even after winning them, it's holding on to them that matters just as much. The energy wanes, and if you don't stay in the fight forever, these bastards are going to come after you and take it all back, just the way they took back labor rights and civil rights and all the other rights,
a whole lot
more with them. But fighting the battle is the key, and I.F. Stone, we could sure use him around today, Doug.
Yeah, I wish he was, too. Well, but as you said, as he said, as I'm saying, one of the things that's very important for people to understand is that fighting the battle is not just something that has to be done, but that in fighting it, you're also making your life richer. You're not just making it richer because you're having something to do. It's because you're doing something that needs to be done. And as you go along, as you know and I know, as you go along, you begin to know and become friends with people you didn't even know who existed, who are the best people you've ever known. I mean, as I look back at my life, and I try to think of the people who were most important to me and who made my life as good as it was, they were all people I was involved with politically, all of them, okay? And in different degrees, in different ways, and so on and so on. But they were people who were fighting for a decent world, and that made them good friends, okay? And that's about the best thing you can say. It isn't a question of can you win, it's a question of is it worth fighting for? That's the question.
And to me, it boils down to one thing. We need to fight for right over wrong. There's too much wrong in this world. There's too much wrong that is inflicted on it by the people who call themselves democratic leaders, and they don't have an ounce of democracy in their veins. Not an ounce. These people are despots. You know, they're despots with a smiling face. I've mentioned in a couple of my articles a book written in the 1980s by a man named Bertram Gross. Do you remember his book, Friendly Fascism?
Yeah.
He wrote about Ronald Reagan.
I refer to it often.
Well, I mean, he nailed it right. You know, when fascism comes to America, and wonderful journalists like George Selders worried about it during the 1930s when Roosevelt was president. He worried about fascism coming to America. I believe he interviewed Mussolini and had the pleasure of having Mussolini throw him out of the country. Well, he was lucky he didn't get his throat cut. He was an American, so he just got the boot. But Gross talked about fascism would come to America with a smiling face, and his prototype leader was Ronald Reagan. Well, maybe Obama would be another prototype. Bush was too crude. The good old boys down south, I guess, went for Bush. But most of the country, that kind of stuff didn't quite wash the same way. But Obama is a lot smoother. He buffaloes a lot of people. And I just can't imagine why his approval rating is even close to 50%, or why anybody of sound mind would ever consider voting for him for Romney either. I mean,
well,
except that
the thing is that the alternative is if it doesn't have enough votes for him, what we're going to get is something that's very, very much worse than it already is now. And the only way that we can make him better is if we get politically involved and let him know about it. Understand? And a third party cannot win in the short run. It can be developed in the short run, but it can't be won, and you can't win with it. So what we have to do is to make it clear to not just to the president, but to the people who want to get elected, to the Congress, that they have to begin to live up to the principles of a decent society. It can't be done any other way. You know, I mean, it isn't just the president, it's the Congress, it's the people in our local governments and so on and so on and so on. They're going to go on being corrupt. And to, because if there's no opposition, we are the opposition. We have to do it, and so on.
You know, one interesting thing, Doug, back in the probably in the 1960s, 1970s, the Democrats ran the Congress. Democrats were in the White House. Well, we had Nixon in 1968, but the Democrats had a long run from the 30s through the end of the 60s. And they controlled the Congress, and Republicans had to come up with a strategy on taking back the government. They began at the local level. They began in cities and towns, in school boards, in mayoral races, in city councils, and they worked their way up. And that's probably the way people need to do it today. Start at the local level, getting the right people sitting on school boards, on city councils, getting a decent person running for mayor and getting elected. And it takes years to do this. Then getting up to the state level, and if that could be accomplished, then start working on it on a federal level. I mean, don't ignore the federal level, but it's a lot easier working locally in your own communities than it is trying to change the whole government. Somebody sitting in Paducah, Kentucky, trying to change the way things work in Washington. It's a lot easier changing the way things work in Paducah, Kentucky. So get on that and work for it. And if they did that, and if they changed Paducah and Peoria and the other cities and towns across America, then everything else is possible.
Okay, I agree with all that. Are we at an end?
We've come to the end of the program. It's amazing how the time goes by, Doug.
Yeah. Thanks for asking me.
It's been a wonderful program with you. I hope
Thank
I
you.
Can get you back another time.
Okay.
And whether it's talking about, are you working on another book by any chance?
Yep. can't help myself. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Doug, again, my great thanks. I do hope I can get you back again for another wonderful program.
Thanks a lot. Ciao, ciao.
Thank you. And I'll just remind my listeners, Thursdays, 11 a.m. Eastern Time.
Hello.
Weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. I always say make it a regular habit. I also wonder, instead of getting the number of listeners I get in other programs like this, imagine the difference if I and others like this could reach millions the way the big boys do it on television. Talk about changing the world, being possible to do it. Well, I have big dreams, and I never stop working for them. I hope the people who listen to this program will dream as well and spread the word to others. And Doug is right. Unless we decide we're going to change things, they'll never change. I think that's a battle worth fighting. I should try to fight it every day. Join us again next week.